the tall man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan, 'cause everyone's lost chin deep in the sand. And what they're trying to sell to you, you shouldn't be buying. Think for yourself, little girl. Don't let them tell you how to run your world, 'cause everyone's the same. Choking back that nervous hurl. And if they tell you they ain't, well, they're just lying. Yeah, they're just lying.
Well, a very hearty welcome to a show called Thinking Clearly, a show about critical thinking and related topics. My name's Bob Frelick with co-host
Julia Minton.
Julia, why don't we start off by you telling the folks a little bit about how they can get in touch with us, interact with us, and a little bit about the podcast version of this show.
Absolutely. You can also find us in your podcast app if you do that.
How do we fit in that little app?
Well, you got to go searching for it. Okay. What I do in my podcast app, and they're all a little different, is you say add feed and you search for Thinking Clearly. We'll come right up. If you'd like to find us on the interwebs, go to thinkingclearly.libsyn.com. And again, Libsyn is Libsyn. Also, we are on Facebook, Thinking Clearly Radio Show on KMUD. Thinking Clearly will bring it right up, and you can talk to Bob and myself. We are real people with real Facebook accounts. We're not just Russian hackers.
Excellent. A few hints about what the topic is for tonight, because I have been doing some reading that just caught my mind.
I have a sneaking suspicion that it's going to be about critical thinking.
It's going to be about critical thinking or a related topic. Oh. That's for sure.
All right. Keeping that open-ended.
But let me tell you a couple things that I came across, a couple articles. There was a recent short interview with Donna Strickland, who was one of the recipients of the 2018 Nobel Prize in Physics. And she was asked, it was a short interview, but one of the questions she was asked is, what advice do you have for current students in the sciences? And this is her reply. She said, quote, do what you want to do. I believe in always going with your gut.
How curious.
It is curious.
Not the kind of thing I'd expect from a physics professor.
Not the kind of thing. Also, there's another article that I read that was really an interesting article about an amazingly productive biochemist whose name was David Baker, who's really on the path to developing a one-size-fits-all flu vaccine in his research, probably a Nobel Prize in his future. But he started out as a graduate student working on trying to understand how proteins fold. Very useful topic. And he was working with a graduate advisor who had already had half a dozen previous graduate students fail with a method that David Baker finally said, listen, I think this will work. He used his intuition. He doggedly pursued that method and was successful in doing it, which gave him a lot of creds and kickstarted his career. So tonight we're going to be talking about going with the gut, our intuitive cognitive processing, with our guest, Dr. Gary Klein. And you know who Malcolm Gladwell is, right? He writes for The New Yorker. He's written several
books.
Name
sounds familiar.
Yeah. Well, he's a pretty respected writer, and he wrote, I think, something like four books, and one of the books that he wrote is called Blink. It was a bestseller.
Mm, I do remember seeing that.
Yeah. The subtitle of that is The Power of Thinking Without Thinking. And here's what Malcolm Gladwell said. No one has taught me more about the complexities and mysteries of human decision-making than Gary Klein. So a little bit of context: in a lot of previous episodes on this show, we've discussed the many ways that our brains fool us, right? Cognitive vulnerabilities in our quick intuitive processing that we've been labeling system one, as many folks do, including biases. Now, Wikipedia, you know how many biases they list in Wikipedia? Take a guess.
100.
114.
Oh, it's so close.
That's a bunch of biases, let me tell you.
That, and that's probably not the comprehensive list.
It's probably growing as we speak. And research has shown that these biases often lead to erroneous judgments and mistaken beliefs.
Well, and I also think it's worth pointing out that sometimes people look to take advantage of your biases.
Exactly.
Which is why it's a vulnerability in some ways.
That's right. And we've also stressed that we can compensate for that a couple ways for those biases. One is first to have an awareness of biases, and that's why we've talked at length about biases. And second, then we can engage our slower, more deliberative reasoning abilities, which is often called system two, as a check on our intuition.
Mm.
And that seems to be the sort of 1-2 punch that we
balance,
get some balance with. Yeah. And so a little bit about Gary Klein. Oh, I do want to say that in one of his books, Gary Klein said, quote, "I believe it is important to counterbalance this negative impression of system one with a sense of awe and appreciation about the insights we create and the discoveries we make." So Gary Klein received his PhD in experimental psychology back in 1969 from the University of Pittsburgh. And he spent his long career partially in academia and the second part of his career as a research psychologist for the U.S. Air Force. And the third part, which he's in now, as author of several books, 8 books. And he is currently in private industry. He is president of a company called Shadowbox LLC, a company which specializes in unique approach offered to businesses and other entities. So, Gary Klein, welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Thank you very much for having me on the show. I appreciate it.
Thanks for joining us.
We appreciate you coming on. And before we get into it, Gary, I do want to remind our listeners that we're going to open the phone lines for comments and questions about tonight's topics and questions for Gary Klein. He's an expert on intuition, insight, and various other things, as you'll find out as we progress. I read your book, your last book, Seeing What Others Don't. And it's a book about the remarkable ways that people get creative insights. And so in reading that book, I know you love stories because you talk about how much you love stories in that book. So I would ask you to start out by telling us your story about how you wound up to be a long champion of the intuitive side of human cognition.
Sure. It all happened by accident. None of it was planned. In the mid-1970s, I went to work at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base as a research psychologist, and it turned out to be a wonderful time to be working there, because the Arab oil embargo had just hit in 1973, and price of fuel went sky high, including jet fuel, which wasn't very convenient for the American economy, and was not very convenient for all of these pilots in the Air Force who were used to flying as much as they wanted and getting all their training, and they just loved to fly, and now they couldn't, and they were going to have to build skills in simulators. And up to that point, simulators were like toys, and they were sort of held in low repute. But now there was no choice, because the pilots couldn't fly as much as they had been used to, as much as they needed. So for me, my team was working on simulator training and how to make it more effective. And my particular topic was, how do you build expertise? What is expertise? How do you build it? How do you build it in a simulator? And so I was studying how people become really talented at things. And I remember one trip that I made to Pensacola. It was someplace in the Florida Panhandle, to Tyndall Air Force Base, and I was interviewing these two pilots, and we were working on a project, building a simulator together, and we were having a productive meeting. And then afterwards, you know, you go to the bar, and you're just talking with them, and they looked around. There was nobody to hear what they were going to tell me, and they said, and remember their tag names. One of them was called Scotty, and the other one was called Mad Dog, and I don't want to go into the details of how Mad Dog acquired his name, his nickname. And they said, you know, we're in charge of building a training program, building the procedural training program for our unit. And I said, fine, that, you know, great. And they said, and we built the procedures for how to do air-to-air combat. And I said, okay, very good. Why are you guys looking so worried? And they looked around to make sure nobody could overhear them, and they said, we have all these procedures, but we don't follow any of those procedures. And I said, oh, really? Well, just write down the procedures you do follow. And they said, we don't follow any procedures. So that was kind of interesting. That was sort of a wake-up call for me from coming from academia, that this was going to be more complicated to study how expertise develops if people aren't just learning rules and procedures and following them. Now, fast forward a number of years, and I'm now doing research on decision-making, and I wanted to see how people can make decisions under very difficult conditions, high time pressure, high uncertainty, and all of the standard approaches, like lay out all the options and look at all the evaluation dimensions. There's not time to do that. So I was studying firefighters, and I wanted to see how they could handle all the demands of their job. And I figured they couldn't do a complete exhaustive job, but you refer to a system, too. There just wasn't enough time because the fires grow exponentially. So I figured they just would generate maybe two options and then see which one was the better one. And I remember the first firefighter I interviewed, he said, yeah, I've been a firefighter 16 years now. And I said, yeah, I want to study how you make decisions. And he said, you know, I've been a firefighter 16 years. I've been a captain 12 of those years. I don't think I've ever made a single decision. And I had just gotten funded from the U.S. Army to study decision-making in firefighters. And this guy is telling me he's never made a decision in 12 years as a captain. And I said, well, how do you know what to do? And he said, oh, it's just procedures. You just follow the procedures. So I was crushed. And before I walked out of his office, I said, okay, let me just take a look at your procedure manual. Maybe there'll be something in there. And he said, oh, it's not written down. You just know. And suddenly the light bulb started to come on about this was not straightforward. Follow the steps, follow the rules, and you'll be safe. This was something else. And I didn't know what it was, and I kept interviewing. We interviewed a few dozen firefighters for that project, and they all said the same thing, that you just know what to do when you get to a scene of a complex fire. You just know. And I thought, how does the first option that pops into your mind, how could that be any good? You want to generate at least a couple of other options, at least one other, and how do you evaluate another option, an option without comparing it to another one? And what we found in looking over our records, and we interviewed them about tough cases, not about straightforward cases, but about really hard kinds of demanding situations that they found themselves in charge of. And what we discovered was that with 12 years, 16 years, 20 years of experience, you build up a repertoire of patterns. You see things, you see them again and again, not exactly the same, but you're building up a sort of a general pattern about what's going on. And when you encounter a new situation, it's a simple pattern match. Within a few seconds, you kind of know what's going on. And by knowing that, you know what to pay attention to. So you're looking in the right places and not wasting time on less important cues. You know what to expect, so that your behavior is always smooth, you're ready for the next part of the situation. And if your expectation is violated, that's a wake-up call. Maybe you've called it wrong. Maybe you've got the wrong interpretation. The pattern that you call up tells you what's a reasonable goal, so that you're trying to do something that's appropriate for that situation. And the pattern tells you what's a reasonable course of action. So within a few seconds, skilled firefighters draw on their experience, on their repertoire of patterns, to know pretty much what to do. And that's what I call intuition. And it's based on experience. It's not magical. It's not occult or anything like that. It's built up through experience and a repertoire of patterns. Now, the second mystery, how do you evaluate an option except by comparing it to another? And we looked at what we had gotten from the interviews, and the answer was you have a single option that pops into your mind, and then you imagine it. You do what we call mental simulation. Is that going to work in this particular setting? And if it is, then you're set. You just carry it out. If it almost works, then you find some way to modify it, to improve it, so that it will work. And if you can't find any way to improve it so that it'll be successful, you discard it. You say, okay, what else can I do? And you keep going down your repertoire until you find something that you think is workable, and that's what you carry out. And so that became our model of decision-making. It's a blend of intuition and analysis. The intuition part is the pattern-matching part, and that feels like magic. Because the ideas pop into your head, you're not specifically and deliberately and consciously looking for them. It just becomes obvious to you what's going on. But then this mental simulation part, that's the analytical part where you're deliberately testing your ideas, testing the course of action to see if it's going to work in this particular context.
Well, Gary, thank you for the very clear explanation and details on that. So it sounds like it's the experts, it's the people themselves that turned you on to this mystery of intuition and piqued your interest. And now that explains why this is your approach is called naturalistic decision making.
Right.
I want to get a little information because you co-authored a paper along with Nobel laureate Daniel Kahneman. And it was one of the most remarkable articles, really, that I've ever read. It was published in the American Psychologist in 2009, and was titled, the title of it was Conditions for Intuitive Expertise, a Failure to Disagree. Now, the article wasn't only just a wonderful summary of your research findings and general approach, which is called naturalistic decision making, but it's also a summary of Kahneman's interests and approach, which is kind of broadly labeled heuristics and biases. But it also served as, in my opinion, an exemplary model for scientists who have opposing views and perspectives to clearly figure out what their differences are and to explore their common ground instead of just unproductively sniping at each other, which we see oftentimes with people in the sciences with opposing views. Can you give listeners a little bit more detail about what went on in that collaboration?
Right. It was a very enjoyable collaboration, and Danny is still a good friend of mine. But the article took 5 years to write, so it wasn't trivial. I have to assure your listeners about that. I've met Danny maybe once at a conference for just a few minutes, but what I didn't know is he had been following my work and had been encouraging some sponsors in the government to support it, because the work on firefighters he thought had a lot of potential. But I only found this out afterwards. So after Danny won his Nobel Prize, I sent him an email congratulating him for the work on heuristics and biases, but also for his earlier work on attention. I mean, he's had several phases of his career where he's been very creative. And Danny wrote back and invited me to come to Princeton. He was at Princeton at the time. And just, you know, talk about things and talk about our views, because he knew that I am not a big fan of heuristics and biases. I think I have some problems with the notion of 114 biases and how we have to worry about that. So there are areas of disagreement. And Danny has had a practice of every now and then inviting somebody who holds contrary views to enter into a collaboration to see what can be learned. And he's done it before, and I had a very fruitful collaboration. I think he's described it as one of the better collaborations that he's had in this way. And we identified, he's very uncomfortable with the notion of intuition, and I'm very uncomfortable with the notion of bias. So we said, you know, where we look at a lot of the same evidence, what can we, where do we find some common ground? And what we found was that there was common ground, that I'm not an advocate of people just trusting their gut when they don't have any experience to back it up. I remember reading a book on poker, and the book was, it had all these wonderful statistics about, you know, what to do with various poker hands or various games in a casino. But then the author at one point said, but if you're at a craps table and nobody is doing well, get away from that table because the dice are cold. And I thought, oh, okay, you've just undercut any credibility here, because that's not a feature of dice. And so I think of intuition as the way we harvest our experience to be able to make rapid judgments and rapid decisions. And Danny and I identified two important conditions for effective intuitions to develop. One, you have to work in an area that is reasonably coherent. If it's a highly random environment, then no, like gambling in a casino, intuitions aren't going to matter. Even if you feel really strong about something, there's no basis for it. And the other is you need to develop skill. You need to get reasonably accurate, reasonably fast feedback on the choices and the assessments you make so that you can learn. And if you satisfy those conditions, you have a basis for building effective intuitions. And so that was the core message of our article. I should say that it was difficult to work with Danny, because he's really a perfectionist. And I thought every now and then, I think, okay, we're close to getting this article published, only to find out that we weren't close to getting the article published. And midway through the collaboration, I sort of had the intuition, we're never going to publish an article together. And so I had a decision to make. Do I continue, or do I find something else that I want to do with my time? And I decided I enjoyed talking and debating with Danny enough that it was worth continuing, even though I was reasonably positive we would never get a publication. So I was fairly surprised when we actually got to the point where we could publish the article. But I also found that Danny is extremely fair-minded. So if he was making changes in a draft, if he thought any of the changes might be ones that would make me uncomfortable, he would call my attention to it. He wasn't trying to slip anything past me or anything like that. He showed a lot of integrity in the way he managed the interaction, and I appreciated that.
How interesting. We're talking about intuition. In talking about intuition here, I'm curious about teasing apart sort of the different ways in which we use the word. In your paper with Kahneman, you both agreed on a definition of skilled intuition as being where, and I'm going to quote, the situation has provided a cue. This cue has given the expert access to information stored in memory, and the information provides the answer. Do you still support that definition of skilled intuition?
Oh, very much so. It basically aligns with the recognition prime decision model that I developed in my research with firefighters.
Excellent. And can you elaborate? I mean, I think that really makes sense as far as defining what skilled intuition is. Can you elaborate on the difference of skilled intuition and other types of intuition?
Right. Well, we have all kinds of intuition. As the book I mentioned earlier about how to gamble in a casino. There's no intuition that this is a good table to be continuing or a bad table to be continuing at. You know, people have these kinds of hunches based on nothing. And so I see a lot of situations where people will just have an uninformed impulse and say, well, that's my intuition and I'm supposed to go with my gut. And I don't feel I'm very positive about that. When people ask me, what do you trust? Should you trust your intuition or should you trust your analytical abilities. And my answer is, don't trust either one. Certainly don't want to trust your intuition, because our intuitions can mislead us, especially if they're not based on prior experience and a history, and if you don't have a chance to test them. But I don't trust analyses either, because I've seen too many cases where the analyses don't hold up, and people have done studies on things, and so this is the final answer. And then 5 years later, the field has a different answer. You look at the field of healthcare and all of the advice about what foods to eat and what foods not to eat, and things keep changing. And I've also seen other cases where analyses mislead people. So I think we need both intuition and analyses. And we need to test both of them and not think that if I avoid intuition, I'm always going to be safe, because that's not true. Or think that I can ignore the data, because that also leads you into error, into a fool's paradise. All I have to do is go with my gut, because you're the Nobel Prize winner you cited at the beginning of the show. That's the advice she gave. Well, I'm not sure I would want to bet my career on going with my gut, especially if I was a high school student trying to pick a career and didn't have much of an experience base.
Yeah, it sounds like the commonality I heard there was trust. And I think we kind of get around that talking about critical thinking sometimes, that, it's good to dig in a little bit and see what things are about. So I've heard of controlled experimental methods in research, where you have a control, an experiment. I have not heard or am familiar with naturalistic research methods. Could you kind of talk about the difference between the two?
Right. There's a stark difference. And if any of your listeners are interested, our next conference on naturalistic decision making will be taking place in June 2019 in San Francisco. We've been holding these conferences for 30 years now. 1989 was the first one that we ran. The difference is this. Controlled experiments are sort of a gold standard for collecting evidence in a careful manner. And we certainly have learned a lot from controlled experiments. However, the tasks that are used are usually fairly artificial. The context is limited. And so there's always an issue, will the results generalize to real-world situations? In naturalistic decision-making, we'll try to bring some of our questions into the laboratory, but usually we study experts. We study firefighters, we study physicians, we study pilots. We study them in messy kinds of conditions that aren't amenable to control, but these are the kinds of issues that have to be understood. So people make decisions not by themselves in a laboratory, just staring at a screen, but in teams, in organizations. They perform tasks that don't have a right answer. They work on ill-defined problems where the goals aren't clear and may become more clear as they pursue solutions. They're working with lots of uncertainty. Typically, the people we study are handling high-stakes decisions, like firefighters and pilots and nurses and physicians. And the people that we study in naturalistic decision-making have expertise. And that's been often ruled out of controlled laboratory environments, because you don't want people to come in who've seen the task before, because you don't know how much experience they have. And it's going to create variability, and that's going to make it harder to get statistically significant results. I remember one laboratory researcher telling me, oh, I give my subjects a lot of practice. I give them 10 hours of practice. And I was thinking, they get 10 hours of practice. I'm just finishing a study with firefighters, and they had an average of about 20 years of experience. It's not even the same organism. So for naturalistic decision-making, we're trying to understand decision-making and sense-making in natural settings with all of the messy contextual variables that the real world throws at us.
Yeah, so it's sort of a complementary approach to the experimental method, and that's what was so good about this paper that you wrote with Kahneman, because I think it really made that clear. And you've already talked about this to some extent, but I think it bears sort of a little bit more detail and underscoring. But in your book, Seeing What Others Don't, I have a quote, and I want to read the quote. It goes like this: experience isn't just about having the necessary knowledge. Experience is about how we use our knowledge to tune our attention. Our background can sensitize us to cues or patterns that others may miss. So you've talked a little bit about that, but it seems to me to be really a key point in learning to shape our experiences and improve our decision-making with that intuitive processing that goes on. Can you say just a little bit more about that, how we use our background?
Right. I think that's extremely important. So we have all this background experience, but it's not just sort of sitting there to provide answers to questions in a controlled laboratory environment. It's there to help us react quickly in ambiguous kinds of environments. And different people will have the same kinds of experience, but draw different lessons from it. And those are the kinds of, we develop our own frames, which are ways of understanding the dynamics of a situation and knowing what to pay attention to, what to expect, what are plausible goals. All of those things emerge from the experiences that we've had, and the experience isn't about just compiling the experience, but putting it into play, putting it into action, so that it governs how we size up situations so rapidly. And, you know, I've been very fortunate in my career to have a chance to interview lots and lots of experts. And the stories that they've told are just very, very inspiring about how they were in tough situations and they could draw on their experience to quickly determine what was a reasonable course of action to be able to manage all the problems that they were facing. And when I hear communities denigrating experts and saying, well, they're biased, you know, they sometimes make mistakes, and they do sometimes make mistakes. But if you look at what they accomplish, it's really stunning.
And if you learn from those mistakes, then that helps develop that expertise. It seems to me like the takeaway message here is that intuition can be very effective, can be trained, but it takes some work to do. In other words, you can't passively just depend upon your intuition to give you the right answer or be amazingly magic about the kinds of decisions we're making and that kind of thing. But it takes some work to actually tune it up.
That's a really important observation. Just having the experience isn't enough. I remember in the first study I did with firefighters, I said, I want to talk to some of your, I talked to the captain of the precinct, and I said, I want to talk to some of your best firefighters. And he said, do you want to talk to the ones who've had the most experience or the ones who are the most skilled? Mm-hmm. And I always assumed that the two went hand in glove. And I said, well, let's put it this way. If it was your house on fire, which of your captains would you want to be in charge of the crew that's called out? And he laughed, and he said, okay, you want to talk about the ones who are best, because some of the people who've been here like 10 years have had 1 year of experience repeated 10 times. They're not learning anything from it. Mm-hmm. What you said is extremely important. Harvesting mistakes is a critical way to develop intuitions, not just saying, okay, I made that mistake, I'll do something differently, but really reflecting and diagnosing, why did I make that mistake? What was I not paying attention to? What tendency did I have that was getting me in trouble here? And that can sometimes be a painful exercise, but if you engage in that as a habit of mind to reflect on mistakes and diagnose why they happen, those are opportunities for you to develop expertise.
Very good. I'm intently listening here, and I'm curious, and I think you've already touched on this, how, you know, me as a layperson can hone in that expertise of intuitive decision making. How can I strengthen that? Or maybe I'm looking to develop a new skill, and that's something I want to put intent and intention into. Developing that intuitive decision making. What you've already given us a couple hints, definitely looking back at our mistakes and learning from them. What else can I do to hone in that intuitive decision making skill?
Okay, so the advice I would give would be that there are several things you can do. One, always seek feedback. Try to gather whatever feedback is available so that you can. Learn from that. Consult with experts. You know, what did they see in that situation? Or use vicarious experiences. Have experts tell you about their tough cases and describe how they handled those tough cases. And don't just listen. Ask questions like, okay, you noticed this. Would I have noticed that? Where would I have gone wrong? And why didn't you go down that path? A critical issue is curiosity. To ask those tough questions, you have to be curious. And we do a lot in our society to stifle curiosity because people, if they're asking, they're afraid they're going to ask questions that make them look ignorant, and so and people will make fun of them because they ask something that's obvious. So it's better not to to expose yourself that way. And so people are inhibiting their curiosity rather than encouraging it. There's something called a growth mindset that you can try to adopt, that if you're having trouble in an area, it doesn't mean that you're bad at it. That's sort of a fixed mindset. I'm either good or bad at math, and if I do poorly on a test, that means maybe I'm not cut out to take any more math. Or it could mean you need to study more. You need to find somebody to work with who can not just tell you what the right answers are, but explain why it's the right answer or diagnose why you're making certain kinds of mistakes. And so if you adopt a growth mindset, that puts you in a better position to build your skills. We've already talked about harvesting mistakes. And the last piece of advice is we're a very, very evaluating society. And when I'm being evaluated, I'm being careful. I'm being defensive. I don't want people to catch me out, see that I got something wrong. And that's the opposite of what you need if you really want to explore and make discoveries and try new things where you are going to make mistakes. So the more we emphasize evaluation, the more we're going to throw monkey wrenches in the discovery process.
Very interesting. And I'm also wondering what can, in particular, like parents and teachers who, you know, shape fragile little minds, what can they do to help facilitate better intuitive cognition?
Right. So they should be aware of, are they encouraging a growth mindset the way they should be? They can be aware of things they may be doing that stifle curiosity. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. if you've had kids, you know, at a certain point you get tired of the kids saying, why? You know, and they keep asking you why, and you just want them to do things. So, you know, because I said so, just do it. Sometimes and usually they really do want to know why. And when we get impatient, it's usually because we're not really sure. We just want them to do what we tell them to do.
Yeah.
And instead, if they're asking reasonable questions, you should look at it as an opportunity to explore with them. If we're going on a trip, you want to certainly prepare so that the trip goes smoothly. But let me tell you, whenever I've gone on, I listen to people come back from trips, and what stories do they tell about their, you know, the plane ride or the train or the ship or anything? Their stories aren't how things went smoothly. The stories are always about, well, you know, this happened and nobody knew what to do, and then here's how we figured it out. Mm-hmm. And so those are the exciting parts of the trip, when people are showing resilience. And so one thing you can do with children is you don't want to ignore preparation, but you want to keep them alert to a sense of adventure and excitement. Like, if things don't go the way they're supposed to, instead of getting frustrated, get a sort of intrigued. This is a chance to make some discoveries. Let's see what we can do about it.
You know, Gary, when I was doing some research for this episode, reading your book, et cetera, that's one of the things that happened in my mind. I have two children, I call them children, 39 and 37. But what I really thought about is what I could have done to actually help them build some of this intuition, you know. I never really thought about that.
And yet you probably intuitively did it anyway.
I hope so. They've made pretty good decisions, so I'm satisfied with that. You've already talked a little bit about the balance between critical thinking. This is a show about critical thinking. So we talk about how to research and evaluate evidence and link that to our claims and conclusions and related topics. And so you've talked a little bit about that. But could you just say any other thoughts that come into your mind about striking this balance between System 1, System 2?
Right. So I tell you what I don't like about critical thinking. I don't like an emphasis on critical thinking that makes you believe that there's right answers and there's a right way to do things and that you've got to try to overcome all of your biases. I don't see that. I don't see any evidence that trying to de-bias people has ever had any real impact on improving performance. I don't like the idea for critical thinking that you need to identify all your assumptions so that you can try to prevent yourself from making mistakes. That's all about avoiding mistakes. So I don't like those aspects of it. Here's what I do like about critical thinking. I like the idea that you're going to be alert to evidence and think about evidence, and also that it... There's a certain type of mistake that I do see people making, which is where they become fixated. And I've seen it. I'm working with a friend of mine who's a physician about diagnostic errors. I've also worked with friends in the petrochemical industry where a panel operator will jump to the wrong conclusion and go down the wrong direction and have trouble recovering. And so I do worry about people making fixation errors, and that's where critical thinking can come into play. And the way it would come into play is not by listing all of your assumptions, but it would be by being aware that you may be wrong. And if you're wrong, you're going to start to see anomalies and inconsistencies. And our tendency... See, fixation isn't just jumping to the wrong hypothesis, because we often do that. That's not the issue. The issue is jumping to the wrong hypothesis and holding on to it despite contrary evidence. And for critical thinking, I would like to see people be more alert to the inconsistencies and the contrary evidence and use that as a stimulus for rethinking their interpretation.
Great comments. Thanks.
Inspired there. I'm going to propose that we rename our show to Being Aware That You May Be Wrong. I really like that. Sorry.
We could make that the subtitle of the show.
All right. We'll see. Bob and I will debate it later.
Yeah, we've talked about this before, about being open-minded and being aware. It's part of our description of critical thinking, actually, is to allow for alternative points of view and alternative hypotheses.
All right. You're right, Bob.
Okay. Well, we're going to open the phone lines, and then I while we're waiting for a phone call, I will ask you another question. And that we're talking to Gary Klein. He's a champion of skilled intuition expertise and the process of developing insights. One last question, and then we'll take some phone calls. Can you say a little bit about your company's approach to consulting and training and where the name Shadowbox came from? I'm really curious about that.
Okay, sure. For all of my career, as I studied decision-making, I always wondered, is there a way to improve decision-making skills and sense-making skills and cognitive skills in general? And I never found any. And then one day, I stumbled upon it. A friend of mine, a firefighter, a guy named Neil Heinz, had developed this technique. It's a scenario-based technique for putting people through a really tough scenario and having them make decisions at certain points along the scenario could be, what do you do, or what are your goals, or what are you paying attention to, what are you worried about? Could be any of those things. And they would have a variety of options, and they had to rank order them, which is, you know, here's five cues, rank order which you're going to pay attention to from the most to the least, and then write down your reasons. And then in parallel, Neil has had a small panel of experts go through the same scenario. They did their ranking, and they wrote down their reasons. And now you can train me, but the experts don't have to be there because we have their rankings and we have their reasons. And when I saw that in action, and I watched Neil put on some workshops with me on where he included the shadow box method, I said, this is what I've been looking for. And that's what Shadowbox is about. It's about having people see the world through the eyes of experts without the experts having to be there. And so essentially you're shadowing the experts. That's where the name Shadowbox comes from. But you're also, shadowboxing is a way for you to practice without getting hurt. And so it sort of blends both of those issues. And we've got a paper and pencil version. We have electronic versions that run on laptops and tablet computers and even smartphones. And we've used it for petrochemical plant operators and military, police, child protective service workers, and so forth. And it's been extremely exciting.
I'm trying to get a clearer picture in my mind of how those workshops go and how that training goes. Can you give us an example of some of the specific things that you do with the folks that you're training?
Sure. So we would have like a group of maybe, you know, 8, 10, 12 people, and we would unfold the scenario. And then at a certain, as the scenario develops, you say at this point, you have three different goals you can pursue. Rank order, which is the most important, second, and third. And so everybody does that ranking and writes down their reasons. Then we say, okay, great. Here's what the experts did. Here's how they ranked.
Oh, I see.
People want to match the experts, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of the game-like part. But the real learning comes in when we say, and here's the reasons the experts provided.
Uh-huh.
And they realize the experts saw the same scenario they did, but they got much more out of it.
Uh-huh.
That's how you see the world through the eyes of the experts.
So you're shaping the behavior.
Right.
And that's part of what you learn from the naturalistic methods. I think we do have a phone caller, so let's take our call right now. Caller, welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Hi, thank you. My name's Jacqueline, and I have a question about when can I feel confident in disengaging from the conversation as far as maintaining my integrity? I'm always wanting to engage and being patient and intellectually curious. There are just times where I feel like I need to end that. And when do you do that?
Okay, so it's a conversation with somebody else, and it can go on forever. And I become impatient when I get a sense that it's not really a dialogue, that the other person has all kinds of canned opinions and is using me as an audience, and it doesn't care about my reactions or my thoughts or isn't showing any curiosity about my perspective, then it's not really a conversation. It's not really a dialogue. And my interests, as soon as I make that diagnosis, that's when I say, okay, life is too short, and I need to find some way to move on and disengage. Is that
what if it feels offensive or violent or assaulting?
Even if
they're hearing you and they're responding to you, but it's with an aggression that allows you to disengage.
So you're worried not about your decision to want to disengage, but about the technique for disengaging without provoking the person. Is that it?
No. I mean, even if someone is responding to you, like you just said, like you feel like you're an audience, but maybe you're not an audience. Maybe they are engaging with you, and maybe they're ping-ponging ideas. But it comes with a kind of threatening tone, insulting, offensive. Are you allowed to disengage them without compromising your sort of intellectual curiosity badge?
Of course you are. And frankly, that's another place where our intuition comes in. You're having a sense that this isn't a totally safe conversation, that I'm not talking about physical safety necessarily, but you're going to be taking some battering during this conversation, and why... That's different from having a debate with somebody who really disagrees with you and gets excited. That can be very exciting. But you're talking about somebody who is insensitive to where you are and maybe deliberately devaluing you and demeaning you. Is that what you have in mind?
I'm just wondering what you think of it when it happens to you.
When it happens to me, I just become... Either I become very disinterested in continuing, or I become fascinated about what is this person really trying to do, and is there a way that I can turn this conversation into something that's more productive? Usually, I'll be thinking about it after I end the conversation. I'm not as good as I would like to be in the middle of a conversation. But certainly, I don't make it a habit of continuing conversations that are going to leave me feeling like my time, not only my time has been wasted, but that I've been devalued and I'm going to have to spend some time recovering. I don't see any point in that.
Let me see if I can snag Julia in on this conversation, because during our last show, we talked about the things that we've learned from doing this show. And if I remember correctly, Julia, one of the things insights that you said you had is that there need to be certain boundaries. And it sounds like this is what the caller is talking about. What are those boundaries, and how do you handle those situations?
Are you asking me now?
I am.
No, geez, all right. I don't know. It's a case by case basis. I too can be a very patient person and sometimes have regretted it. I have to go a little bit with what Gary Klein's saying. The feeling of being devalued, I think, is very real. I think when that feeling arises, it's good to say something about it and bring it to the surface. Generally, I think if you're engaged in a conversation that is feeling hostile or negative in some way that you have an inkling to disengage from, I think transparency is key. So saying, I feel like you're being hostile right now. I feel like you're devaluing me as a human being or my opinion. If this continues to go this way, I'm not really inclined to continue to engage in this conversation. To me, that's kind of the best, because ending a conversation abruptly without knowing why isn't going to help. And it isn't going to prevent that situation from happening again. But I do think it is important to not be too quick to disengage, because sometimes the really good work comes from those difficult conversations. But it is hard. I think it's a person by person basis. But most of all, being transparent, because sometimes the other person will say that the hostile person in the conversation doesn't realize what they're doing. They may not realize that they're, you know, speaking to a marginalized person in a certain way that's triggering. And for that person to be able to say, you know, this is what's happening, why I'm being triggered, and why I'm not inclined to continue this conversation, is in itself a teaching moment.
All right. Caller, is that helpful?
Let me just add another wrinkle to this. Okay. In my collaboration with Danny Kahneman, I found it extremely fruitful, even though we disagreed on many fundamentals, because I respected him so much, and I had the sense he respected me enough to take what I said seriously. And sometimes, you know, the tip-off for me is, how do people listen to me? And are they looking for holes in my argument, or are they listening for nuggets that they can build on and improve the collaboration? That's what gives me a sense of whether we're going to get someplace or not.
And I also want to mention, I think that's a very good example, and something more of us, even lay people, could do is seek out people with decidedly different points of view and have lunch, have a cup of coffee, talk about it, understand why you see things differently. It's something that, you know, even you and Danny, it's not even that super common in academia, let alone on the streets.
Okay, well, thank you very much, caller. We're coming to the end of the hour here. And so I want to thank you very much, Gary Klein, for your input and great explanations as being a champion of skilled intuition, expertise, and developing insights. Currently president of Shadowbox LLC. And Gary, do you want to give out any other contact information to our listeners?
Well, the website is www.shadowboxtraining.com for anybody who'd like to learn more about it.
Okay, and I'll link to that on our Facebook page, and I'll link to your bio. Thank you very much for the call. Good insight, and thank you again, Gary Klein. And thanks to our engineer, Nate Dogg, for doing a great job.
Very insightful conversation.
Yes.
Thank you, Bob.
And thank you, Julia. And until next time, keep thinking clearly.
Think for yourself, little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan. Cause everyone's lost chin deep in the sand. And what they're trying to sell to you, you shouldn't be buying. Think for yourself, little girl. Don't let them tell you how to run your world. Cause everyone's the same, choking back that nervous hurl. And if they tell you they ain't, well, they're just lying. Yeah, they're just lying.
This program was produced in KMUD's Redway Studios and is provided courtesy of KMUD, people-powered radio.